Tonight we have two readings. Could people take a pew Bible and turn to Isaiah chapter 42, and we will be reading verses 1 to 9. Page 727, starting at verse 1. Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will bring justice to the nations. He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smouldering wick he will not snuff out. In faithfulness he will bring forth justice. He will not falter or be discouraged till he establishes justice on earth. In his law the islands will put their hope. This is what God the Lord says. He who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and all that comes out of it, who gives breath to its people and life to those who walk on it. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness. I will take hold of your hand. I will keep you and will make you to be a covenant for the people and a light for the Gentiles, to open eyes that are blind, to free captives from prison, and to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another or praise to idols. See, the former things have taken place, and new things I declare. Before they spring into being, I announce them to you. Could we now turn to page 969, where we'll be reading Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 to 16. Starting at verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Thank you very much indeed. I think I'm booming a bit. Matthew 5 and verse 14, the first phrase there. Jesus speaking, you are the light of the world, he says. Well, those are familiar enough words which sound innocent to us. But when Jesus first said them, it was like a bomb going off in the ears and minds of those who heard them. A spiritual revolution was certainly starting. He was saying, it's time for a change on a massive scale. I don't know how you voted, but in the last few weeks we've seen Tony Blair and the New Labour Party tearing up the map of the political landscape. They've redrawn the map over the last few months and years with themselves at the centre. And he's taken over the centre and shoved aside those who were there earlier. In tonight's passage, we'll see Jesus making the same kind of move on a global and spiritual level. He's shredding the existing map of spiritual reality, tearing it up in pieces. He's redrawing a new map with himself right at the centre. He's taking over the central position and elbowing aside those who were there before him. If you're not a Christian tonight, I want you to see the breathtaking authority of Jesus Christ in action. I want you to sense his authority personally. I want you to encounter him, to come face to face with him. If you're already a Christian, I want to change your mind about what this passage means. As I prepared this, William helpfully reminded me that this is one of the passages that Read, Mark, Learn leaders use in their training. It's one of the passages that is taken and is used to illustrate all the howlers that you can make when you handle a passage in the Bible. And I say that the great danger for you tonight, if you're one of the Read, Mark, Learn leaders, is that you'll sit there giving me points out of 10 for the way that I handle it, sitting there all smug and comfy because you think you already know what it means. But if you think it means what I think you think it means, I think you're wrong, if I might put it like that. So for the first few minutes tonight, I'm going to explain the passage the way it's usually understood. which I now think is wrong. And then I'll tell you what I think it really means, and we'll see, as I say, the breathtaking authority of Jesus. So there are just two headings tonight, and the logical structure is very straightforward. I'm going to start with not that, the usual way of understanding this, and then come on to but this instead, which we'll come to in just a few minutes. So here's what the passage is not about. It's not about what I've called the double duty of God's people. The double duty of God's people. Look at verse 14 with me again. Jesus refers to two distinct communities in that phrase. You are the light of the world. One community at either end of the phrase. You, that's the crowd sitting on the mountainside around him, listening to him. And then everybody else, the world. Look at verse 13, the first phrase. You are the salt of the earth, says Jesus. Two communities, again. You, the crowd listening to him, and the earth, everybody else. Jesus is using salt and light to define the relationship between these two distinct communities, the church and the world. And he's saying the church is the salt of the earth, whatever that means, and the light of the world, whatever that means. And when he says, you are the light of the world, Jesus is implying something about the world. He implies it's a place of darkness with no particular light of its own. It needs a light source introduced into it to push back the darkness. And when Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth, he again implies something about the world. It's like a rotting carcass, rotting fish or meat. It needs salt rubbed into it to reduce the rot, to stop the rot. So, God gives the church a double role in the world. One negative, one positive. Salt negative, light positive. Salt in the first century, so the RML exercise goes, was a preservative. No fridges, hot climate. So, salt is a picture of the church as a social preservative. And one role of the church is to slow down the process of social decay by taking a stand against rising levels of crime and corruption and working for better social structures and legislation and campaigning for freedom for individuals and civil rights for minorities and an end to all kinds of discrimination. You get the drift? The church is like salt, stopping the rot, slowing down the process of social decay. The other role of the church is to push back the spiritual darkness in every way possible, to bring the light of the knowledge of God to a world in spiritual darkness, to shine the light into the office or street or house or family or culture or team or orchestra, everywhere and anywhere, to push back the darkness. So the double duty of the church is negative and positive, slowing down social decay, pushing back spiritual darkness. And Jesus in these verses is not just stating the double duty. Here's the job, guys, go get on with it. He's warning that this double duty is not easy. Look at verse 13. He says, salt easily loses its saltiness. And salt that's lost its saltness is useless. In verse 15, he warns that light easily stops shining, gets hidden. If you take these two metaphors in this way, salt and light, here's the issue for the church in every community. I'll put it like this. How can the church retain its distinctive identity and at the same time make a significant impact on the wider community? In other words, what does it mean for the church to be in the world, but not of the world? Let me illustrate it like this. Similar issues face every cultural minority. I had lunch with some friends earlier in the week, and about half a mile from here, in Whitechapel and Spitalfields, there's a massive Bengali community. We had a great time. I was learning about it. They were teaching me. Some people from India, mostly from Bangladesh. Mainly Sylheti speakers. Some of you I know work among them, from northern Bangladesh. Many of them are illiterate. They very kindly put all these signs at the London Hospital into Sylheti and then found that people couldn't read or write. Many of the older women don't speak any English at all. But they don't need to. It's a Sylheti-speaking community. It has a clearly defined national, cultural, and linguistic boundary. It's, if you like, a little cultural island with its own Bengali identity. It's hard for insiders to get out, and it's very hard for outsiders to get in. It's just down the road. Well, there are many churches like the Spitalfields Bengali community. Little islands with their own cultural identity. They speak the spiritual equivalent of Sylheti as far as their friends are concerned. I mean, who knows what they're on about? The cultural boundaries are clearly and tightly defined. They make no real impact at all on the wider community around them. It's hard for insiders to get out, and virtually impossible for outsiders to get in, even if they wanted to. And then we had some, sandwiches and some chocolate after lunch, something like that, and they told me about another Bengali community, a little bit further away from here, about 20 minutes in the car, at Forest Gate now. There the Bengalis are in a minority, and the boundary between the Bengalis and the wider community is blurred. The Bengalis don't want to lose their distinctive culture, but they are really keen to take on an English national identity. And a Bengali man said to my friends this. He said, "Will you take my two boys every Saturday? Whatever you're doing, will you let them follow you around? Take them to the library, take them to the supermarket. Teach them to walk and talk and think like you do." An astonishing thing for someone to say from another racial cultural community. See the strength of his desire for his boys to be at home in the wider community. He's willing to risk them losing their Bengali cultural identity so that they fit in to the wider community. Well, there are churches like that second Bengali community. Churches that are so keen to be in touch and to fit in the wider community, they lose their distinctive Christian identity, and their church buildings become community centers, and their ministers become social workers, and their members are normally social casualties. There's nothing salty about them anymore. They have no light to offer the community around them. London is full of them. And Jesus is explaining the double duty of the church, this way of understanding these verses, precisely because it's tricky to get it right. It's not easy to be salt and light at the same time. And every church is in danger of losing its saltiness and hiding its light. And we need to retain our identity and be fully involved in the wider community. That seems to me that's a neat way of understanding this particular passage. Those are real issues that every Christian and every Christian community does face. It's the way I always used to understand this passage, and I now think it's wrong. So what's wrong with it? You look at verse 14 again with me. Look at that first phrase. "You are the light of the world," says Jesus. If you've been following through with me so far, we've been reading as if the two communities Jesus has in mind are at either end of the phrase. You, that's the crowd listening to him. And the world, everybody else. And we've been reading that phrase as if Jesus is talking about how the church serves the world, the double duty of the church in the world. But that's not right. If you're new to us, there's no reason why you should know this. And if you're a Christian, you may have forgotten. But when Jesus spoke these words, the thing to remember is that there was already a church in the world. There was already a church right at the heart of the spiritual map of reality. And the Old Testament is the story of God's remarkable strategy to make himself known to the nations of the world. If you've read it ever, you'll know he took one man and established a relationship with him. And then he made a nation from that one man's family. And he gave them a land of their own, a place where they could enjoy their relationship with him. And God set up this particular nation derived from that one man's family as a model society. And the plan was for them to be like a lamp or a beacon for the nations of the world. They were supposed to be the light of the world. That was at the heart of our Old Testament reading. And then God's plan was for the nations of the world, like moths, to be drawn towards them. By seeing and experiencing God's model society, these people would say, well, what kind of God allows people, helps people to live like this. He must be amazing. And the point of the plan was for the nations to come to know God as their creator and discover his love for them. And God set up the model society for precisely that reason, to be a light for all the nations of the world to discover him. Now look at verse 14 again. You, says Jesus, are the light of the world. There are two distinct communities in the foreground of the verse and one in the background. And look at the two communities in the foreground. We need to draw the line slightly differently. On the one hand, there is the crowd listening to him. You, says Jesus. But on the other, there is the light of the world, God's model society. So what Jesus is doing, he's not talking about the double duty of the church in the world. He's actually tearing up their existing map of spiritual reality. And he's redrawing the map with himself right at the center. He's taking over the center and shoving aside those who are already there before him. And he's redefining the boundaries of the church in the world. And he's announcing the real identity of God's people. He's doing a new labor at a global and a spiritual level. Now, if you're completely lost at this point, please don't worry. I'm going to try to explain. This is now what the passage is about. All that was what it was not about. Okay, so if you've been asleep, now wake up, all right? If you knew nothing about the passage before, and all that was a waste of time, I'm very sorry, but now, this is what it is about. And here's a heading if you want one. A new map of spiritual reality. A new map of spiritual reality. Look at verse 14 again, because now I think we can hear the thrust of it. Jesus says, you are the light of the world. And when he says you, he means you listening to me here in Galilee and not those people down there in Jerusalem. See, from now on, God's model society is not based on nationality or ethnic identity or political geography. It's time for a change, says Jesus. In the Old Testament, well, God's model society was based on national identity. It was based on Jewish culture, a Jewish calendar, a Jewish diet. It was based on Palestinian geography. Promised Land was right at the center of the map of spiritual reality. All through the Old Testament story, that was the place to meet with God, where he would make himself known. Well, that's all finished, says Jesus. From now on, God's model society is based on personal loyalty to me. Do you see what I mean by breathtaking authority? It's an astonishing claim to authority. One of the most colourful characters among the local Bengali community is an old man called King Ghaffar. I don't know if Marcus is here, but actually, I don't know if you knew you had royalty at one of the DC evenings. King Ghaffar came to one of the DC evenings a few months ago. And next time you go for a curry on Brick Lane, ask them if they know King Ghaffar. He wears bright red with a sombrero, or pale green. It's all very colourful, always. And he's king of the United Kingdom of Bengal. If you know your geography, you'll know that there's no such place as the United Kingdom of Bengal. Because poor old Ghaffar is a bit crazy, really. In fact, you might say he's lost quite a few of his marbles. But the Bengalis take care of him. They respect the elderly. And they're superstitious people, and they think that if someone's a little crazy, well, maybe there's a demon behind him. So it's a mistake to cross him. And so for King Ghaffar, they buy him curry and they take care of him. Now the kingdom that King Ghaffar proclaims, and he walks up and down Brick Lane proclaiming his kingdom, announcing that he's the king, has nothing to do with political geography. It'll never appear on a map. It's nothing to do with racial or cultural identity. There's no need to be a Bengali or a Bangladeshi. His kingdom is open to anybody. It's a matter of personal loyalty. Look at verse 14 again. Jesus says, you are the light of the world. From now on, the boundary lines of God's model society are being drawn differently. no longer national, political, or cultural. God's model society is now a matter of personal loyalty to me, says Jesus. Look at verse 13. He says the same thing differently. He says, you are the salt of the earth. That's another way of describing the role of God's people, Israel, in the world. They thought of themselves as the salt of the earth. They were essential for the spiritual life and health of the rest of the world. Well, you are the salt of the earth, says Jesus to those listening to him. You're taking over from them. And the rest of the verse explains the reason. Look at verse 13. Understand it quite differently now. He says, if salt loses its saltiness, well, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. He's referring to God's existing church, the people who were at the center who are being shoved aside by Jesus, God's ancient people, Israel. They, in verse 13, according to Jesus, are salt that's lost its saltiness. They're now useless for anything. God is throwing them out. He's finished with them. He's replacing them. He's happy for the Romans to, verse 13, trample all over them. And look at verse 14. He says, you are the light of the world. Well, that was Israel's job. Every Old Testament reader, everyone who knew the Old Testament story, that Israel was to be the light for the nations of the world, that beacon, lamp for the moths to come in and see. Well, you're taking over, says Jesus. And again, he explains the reason. Look what he says about the city on the hill. He says, a city on a hill cannot be hidden. Now, if you read the verses the other way, as if this was talking about the double duty of the church and warning about the difficulty of our double duty, you have to understand those words as being something like this. A city on a hill cannot be hidden except when it's in a valley. Or except when the light goes out. But I think what is going on here, and I don't want to be dogmatic about this, is something quite different. Jesus says, a city on a hill cannot be hidden. Well, what is the central city of ancient Israel, if not Jerusalem? Which it is, itself, on a hill. And if he's referring to Jerusalem, I think he's saying something like this. A city on a hill cannot be hidden, and we all know what goes on in Jerusalem. And then verse 15 is saying, a lamp is lit not to be covered up and hidden. Lamps are for light. So in verse 16 he says, well, go on then, shine. Take on Israel's role. Be God's model society, that men may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. And that was the point of God's original model society. That when a camel trader or someone like that came into Israel, sold a lot of camels, went for a drink. He was so impressed by the relationships and the caliber of the lives of those people and the way they treated each other, and looked after him as an outsider, and looked after those who were weak and poor. He was so impressed that he said, who is the God behind these people that helps them live like this? Well, Jesus is now saying, you are taking over that ancient role that belonged to them. And I think this way of reading the passage fits the wider context also. If you were here last week, you will have seen those eight sayings, what we call the Beatitudes, all have a cutting edge to them. What Jesus does is take their ideas about what it means to be spiritual, and he shreds them. He says, these people have God's approval, not those over there who are impressive to you. He says, this is what it means to be spiritual, not that. Well, now this week, he takes their map of spiritual reality, the way they cast the spiritual sphere, and rips it to pieces. And he puts himself right at the heart, and those who listen to him, those who follow him. He redefines the identity of God's people at the heart of God's world. From now on, God's people, if you like to think of it like this, have a new center of gravity. No longer Jerusalem, now Jesus. And as we'll see in the coming weeks, the rest of the sermon explains how Israel has lost its saltiness and failed to shine as light. And he'll give us examples and show how the church takes over Israel's role. But I want to come back to that phrase in verse 14, the start of verse 14. You, says Jesus, are the light of the world. And I want to bring home some of the implications of just that single phrase and the passage around it, if I may. To you first, if you're not a Christian, and then to you, if you are. If you're not a Christian, I want to ask you two short questions, and here's the first one. What kind of map of spiritual reality do you live by? I mean, everybody has one. Everybody has some kind of view of how the world fits together, where we're from, where the journey began, or where it was before our particular journey began, and where the journey ends, and how to make sense of everything in between, and how to travel in the right direction. It may not be a familiar way of thinking about the way we live, but we do all have some kind of map that makes sense of the way that we live. If you're not a Christian, may I ask you, what does your map say about where we come from or where we're going? And who is at the center of the map? And where is Jesus? Is he in the frame at all? Is he on the map at all? Well, there's the first question for you if you're not a Christian. What kind of spiritual map are you living by? And here's the other one. What do you make of Jesus? I mean, doesn't it strike you as breathtaking arrogance to take the spiritual map of a whole culture with all their history behind them, to take the self-understanding of a whole people that God has put them at the center of the world to be a light for the nations and to rip it to shreds and say, that's all finished now and I'm here. And those who'll listen to me, and those who'll follow me. Or is he just a bit crazy, maybe, to say something like that? As crazy as King Ghaffar? Or is he rather more sinister than that? Is he possessed by something beyond himself that is extremely unpleasant to treat people like that? Well, they're both logical possibilities, and both were adopted at the time. Some did think he was crazy, others thought he was something far worse. The truth is that Jesus redraws the map of spiritual reality with himself right at the center, because that's where he belongs. And if you're ever going to become a Christian, you'll have to submit yourself to that kind of authority. He'll take your existing map of reality, whatever it is, and tear it up. And he'll replace it with an accurate version, with himself at the center where he genuinely belongs. Now, may I ask you, when will you be ready for him to do that for you? What's stopping you allowing him to do that for you when you see him in action like this? And for those of us who are Christians, the authority of Jesus is just as searching. He rips our map of spiritual reality into just as many pieces. Look at verse 14 again, that opening phrase. He says, you are the light of the world. And when he says that, the you is plural. But most of us think like spiritual Thatcherites. You may remember her. You may remember that for her, there was no such thing as society. Only individuals. Isn't that how we think of ourselves? As isolated individuals. We think of ourselves as individually as the salt and the light in our offices or in our students' union or along our family, or along our street, in our family, in our team. And if we think like that, what counts is our integrity and our standards and supporting the ref and paying our expenses and not filling our taxes. But Jesus speaks of a much bigger vision. It's a new map of the whole of spiritual reality that he's drawing. It's a new view of God's model society, not based on race anymore, or culture anymore, or geography anymore, but personal loyalty. And if listening to him brings us into that new society, Well, then it's the quality of our relationships that counts with our Heavenly Father. Surprise, surprise, that's what he goes on to teach on. With each other, with those around us. The world no longer revolves around me, but around us. And we need to come to terms with that. Look at verse 14 again, the other end of the phrase. Jesus says, "You are the light of the world." But most of us think like spiritual members of the British National Party. It's just that our horizons are rather narrower than theirs. And Jesus, again, is redrawing the map of spiritual reality on a global scale. And from now on, the whole world is part of our spiritual responsibility if we're going to listen to him and follow him. We belong to a society which is not gathered together in one place on the map, but scattered right across the globe. You can't all go there, but we do need to know what's going on there and to welcome everybody from out there who finds themselves in here. Do you see how that short phrase, "You are the light of the world," is not as innocent as it sounds at first? It must have been like a bomb going off in their minds when they realized the implications, some of them, of what he was seeking to say. Let's pray together as we sit. Lord Jesus Christ, we want to acknowledge your breathtaking authority. We thank you for announcing a change in the map of all of spiritual reality. We thank you for coming among us, for teaching us, for dying to make us members of God's model society. We ask for your forgiveness for our own foolish self-centeredness, for our limited vision and our local horizons. And we ask you to take us and teach us to listen to you and to live for you, for the honor of your name. Amen.